Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as you know, we've been covering the Supreme Court decisions all this week and all this month. And as you know, if you've been listening, after this high drama week on voting rights, marriage rights, affirmative action rights, and more, things are going to change in the real world. And we're going to step back and look at the term as a whole now and catch up on a decision or two that didn't quite crack the headlines but might be worth a closer look. Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, is with us for this. Hi, Adam. Welcome back
to WNYC. Thank you.
So last weekend, before this final flurry of rulings, you wrote a piece called Supreme Court Weighs Cases Redefining Legal Equality, anticipating how the court might reshape one of the Constitution's greatest commandments, the equal protection of the laws. So now that the marriage rights, voting rights, and affirmative action cases are in, does something tie them together for you in terms of a sort of Roberts Court equal protection doctrine?
It sure does. So there's a conception of formal equality, a kind of mechanical conception of equality, which says you just have to treat everyone the same as everyone else. And what the court did in at least two of the cases quite clearly was to say that you have to treat gay couples as you treat straight couples for purposes of federal benefits, and you have to treat southern states the same as northern states, notwithstanding their history of discrimination. The third case on affirmative action is a little harder to get into that template because the court tightened somewhat the rules on affirmative action but didn't do anything particularly bold. But it's not at odds with this general idea that the court there, too, wants colleges and universities to treat black students as they treat white students.
You know, last June, of course, it was high drama season. It's always high drama season in late June at the Supreme Court. Last year, it was the Obamacare ruling. Other years, other things. How did this week compare to what you've seen in the past in terms of the tension in the room, the public emotion on the steps, the sense of history in the making?
Much bigger. No doubt that the health care decision was huge, but people cared about it in a political sense. Nobody really cared about the legal issue about the Commerce Clause. They cared about whether this was good or bad for the president or whether it was good or bad for people seeking health insurance. Here, you really had, in three successive days, three huge cases on much more visceral social issues, affirmative action, voting, and marriage. And the marriage decision, I think, captured public attention on a deeper level than healthcare did. A lot of people have very strong views about same-sex marriage.
And I will mention your forthcoming e-book. Folks, you'll have to wait till July 9th for this one, but Adam is writing an e-book called To Have and Uphold about the Supreme Court and gay marriage, coming out on July 9th. Can I ask you, what is Clarence Thomas's legacy on the court on these racially charged cases? I always thought having Clarence Thomas as the only black person on the Supreme Court is like having Noam Chomsky as the only Jew at the UN, you know, from the group, but opposed to the positions of probably 90% of the group on the salient issues. Do his votes this week on affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act and over his career bear that out?
He has taken a very consistent, and most people would say principled, hard line against racial classifications from the government, whether for good or ill. He doesn't want the government's help. He thinks that that black people can make it on their own. And in all of these cases, he takes a very hard line against any kind of, he'd call it discrimination, whether it's benign or not, whether it means to help historically disadvantaged groups or not. And that's been his position since he was a very young man.
Even the Voting Rights Act, Section 4, Section 5, not just affirmative action?
Yes, he certainly voted with the conservative majority. In fact, he would have gone further than his four conservative colleagues who only struck down the so-called coverage formula, saying that Congress has to go back to the drawing board to decide which states need federal oversight. He said he would have gone further and strike down the part of the law, the actual heart of the law called Section 5, that allows the federal oversight in the first place.
And how about the chief? after the Obamacare ruling a year ago, you'll remember conservatives were, you know, ready to kick Chief Justice Roberts off the island. So how do you put that together with this year's decisions and his whole tenure to describe how much he is moving the court and the country to the right?
He's doing what he can. He's back on board with his usual conservative allies. The healthcare decision will probably turn out to be a career-long outlier, the only occasion on which he's joined the four-member liberal bloc and no other justice. I was a tiny bit surprised in the Defense of Marriage Act case that he was willing to say that that he would have upheld the law. He had an exit ramp there to say that there was no standing, that he could have gotten rid of it on procedural grounds. And he didn't write very much, just a sentence or two, and he didn't join Justice Scalia's very, very vicious dissent. But he did put down a marker that, as for same-sex marriage, he does not think the Constitution protects that right.
Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent. I saw your analysis last month titled Corporations Find a Friend in the Supreme Court. What was that conclusion based on?
Lots of factors, partly anecdotal, but mostly a new study in the Minnesota Law Review by Judge Richard Posner, who's a very prominent federal appeals court judge, an economist at the University of Chicago named Bill Landis, and a political scientist at USC named Lee Epstein, who looked at all of the cases since World War II and concluded that the Roberts Court is by far the most pro-business court we've had in many, many decades, and that the two justices of the many justices who served in that time most likely to vote for business are the two George W. Bush appointees, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito.
One interesting workplace ruling the other day that we haven't gotten to talk about on the show and I've been wanting to is the one that illegal harassment of an employee at work cannot take place by another employee, only by the employee's supervisor. Did I get that right? And did you look at that one closely enough to tell us what it means?
It's your characterization is basically right. You can still sue over coworker harassment, but it's much harder. So the question of who is a supervisor is very, very important. And here in a 5-4 decision, the conservatives against the liberals, the court said that you need to have actual authority to hire and fire. Your authority to make someone's life miserable is not good enough. And that's a typical Roberts Court decision, incremental, but a steady chipping away at the rights of employees to sue for employment discrimination, people injured by products to sue, say, the makers of drugs, and cutting back on class actions, favoring arbitration. In a whole array of ways, there's no question but that the Roberts Court is very good for business.
Was the gene patenting decision an exception to that when they ruled that Myriad Genetics cannot patent naturally occurring human genes, quote-unquote, having to do with the BRCA gene that's used in breast cancer testing, breast cancer risk testing. Was that an exception to that, or does that favor business in some other way?
Well, you know, in patent cases, there are typically businesses on both sides, so it's a little hard to say which is the pro-business ruling. The other thing that case illustrates is that the court, even though we focus on their 5-4 cases, almost half the time this term issued 9-0 decisions, and that was one of them. So the court sends out mixed signals on some of this stuff. But I don't think I would put the patent cases in the pro or anti-business column.
Are you at the court today?
No, I'm back at the bureau.
Because I thought I heard something on the news, and tell me if you know about this, that they actually issued a couple of things this morning, even though yesterday was the last big ruling, and they declined to take two more gay marriage cases from two states, I don't even remember which ones, but that seemed to go, from the report I heard, more to the heart of whether gay marriage could be banned by a state. And, of course, they dealt with Prop 8 in California yesterday on technical grounds as to who has standing. And I think you'll agree that both in DOMA and in Prop 8, they avoided the fundamental question of whether gay marriage should be seen as protected under the Constitution.
Yeah, that's quite right. They did issue some orders this morning. Basically, what they'd done is this whole pileup of cases on gay marriage had been sitting on the court's docket awaiting the decisions we got yesterday. And the court basically just said, we're done for now. We've told you what we're going to tell you. Come back in a couple of years.
Is the Voting Rights Act really gutted, or is some of the reaction to this overheated?
No, that is truly a major decision, and civil rights groups, which will often try to spin a decision and certainly tried to find the silver lining in the affirmative action decision, are right to say that this is a setback for what was a landmark civil rights piece of legislation. It's much harder to push back against restrictions on voting that hurt minorities without the kind of federal oversight the law used to require, which means that a state which wants to change a voting procedure first has to get permission from the federal government. In getting rid of that, and it's almost certainly gone for good, the court took a big step in the direction of saying we don't need those protections anymore. The nation has changed so much since the civil rights era that we can go back to regular kinds of voting lawsuits where you don't need advance permission from the federal government, but you can handle problems with after-the-fact lawsuits.
And they made a big point of upholding Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which says basically, of course, you cannot discriminate on the basis of race,
right,
in drawing district lines and setting up other kinds of voting laws. And so people can still go to court and sue under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It's just that the burden of proof becomes on the plaintiffs now. There isn't this pre-clearance by the federal government.
And, Brian, of course, time matters in elections. So if a week before an election somebody changes where the polling place is or does away with early voting or starts to require voter ID, it's one thing to get into court and persuade a judge to hear the case right away and perhaps issue an injunction. It's another thing to say none of that stuff counts until the Justice Department or a federal court in Washington blesses it.
Well, it has been a very dramatic year and certainly a very dramatic last few weeks at the U.S. Supreme Court. Adam Liptak has been covering it for the New York Times. Thanks for coming on and taking a little step back with us today. In our 10 or 15 seconds remaining here, anything big you already know we'll look forward to in the next term, which begins in October?
Next year, recess appointments, biggest case so far.
Whether President Obama can use recess appointments or whether others can block them in certain circumstances to get nominees in that the Senate might not confirm. All right, Adam, thanks a lot again. Have a nice summer. Maybe get a little break now.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.